Blog Talk Radio.
Aloha. Welcome to Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. And as they love to say, or sometimes they don't like to say, take two, Kubrick, the infamous take 115. Thankfully, this did take three takes. We appreciate the guests rolling with this. Meredith, everyone, Harry, this is going to be a fun show. Unfortunately, we have to cut a little bit off of it because of a technical glitch that thankfully we got solved. Thank you, movie gods. Today, we have cinematographer Alan Jacobson. Look him up on IMDb, a lot of credits, but we're going to jump into a film titled Strong Island, which is nominated for an Oscar this year in the Best Documentary Feature Length category. And we are so thankful to have a cinematographer on because we had another of the documentary nominees on and we had the director. So this is great that we get a different perspective. And of course, being the cameraman, that is so essential. And this was a really great film. And I'm going to also say this really quickly once the guest is on. We do not tell the guests anything we want to hear. This is for new listeners, new supporters. People that will be hearing this for the first time, there's no point in saying anything people don't want to hear or that people want to hear just to say it. We also don't bash a film, so you will never have an episode of Talking Pictures where we didn't enjoy it. In all honesty, Al Pacino could make a dud, and I would say we're not interested in an interview. So let's see. Let's get rocking and rolling. Are you there?
Hi, Paul. It's Alan.
Hello, Alan. Welcome. And by the way, I usually ask if a guest wants to go by Mr. I just said Alan. So what works better for you?
That's all good. Alan, it is.
Excellent. All good is one of my favorite sayings. So we'll jump into this. And so, you know, I was letting the guests know, I don't say one word that a guest wants to hear. So everything we say is sincere. And one ground rule, no censorship. So say what you need to say, especially in the heaviness of this story. I noticed in the press kit, it talked about not use. And congratulations also on being an associate producer.
Thank you.
It talked about. Oh, you're very welcome. It talked about being a documentary without pans or tilts. And what I like to do is just briefly, if you could give me a quick synopsis, because you know more of what the film's about than I do.
Sure. Strong Island is a story of what happened to director Yancey Ford's family after Yancey's older brother, William Ford, was shot and killed in an altercation at a car repair shop in 1992. And the film takes that tragic moment as a jumping-off point to explore some of the systemic problems that enveloped the Ford family after William was killed. And the film tries to be an interrogation of this idea of reasonable fear and why it is that young black men in this country can be killed seemingly. Sometimes without, oftentimes without, without cause, and this idea of reasonable fear being an excuse why folks get away with doing such a thing. So, the film is a fairly intense exploration of these ideas, and at its heart, it's a very intimate story of the Ford family and what they suffered through. But it's really can be seen as a global story. You know, a very macro story of the systems which this country has been operating in for a long, long time, hundreds of years, as a matter of fact. So, you talked about the stillness of the film. I mean, it was one thing that Yancey and I talked about right at the beginning, which, you know, Yancey was a curator at POV, the PBS documentary strand, for about 10 years, and was producing that series when he was starting to work on the film. And so at our first meeting, I realized that I was talking to a director who had literally probably seen every American documentary made in the last 10 years. And with that understanding of the documentary canon, Yancey, I think, very bravely said, you know, I don't want to do anything like that we've seen before. We're going to try to make something different and tell this story in a way that could probably only be told by someone in Yancey's position of, you know, being a family member. So it was a remarkable opportunity for me to work with Yancey to try to develop these visual ideas that would help support some of the storytelling that Yancey wanted to do about this issue. And that's one of the things that led to this very limited, controlled, focused camera work.
Well, that I was going to say that was what made it, I don't want to say easier, because I love a challenge, because I thought of this as a completely easy challenge discussion, because I thought, wait a minute, okay, so a cinematographer, and I'm not saying this about your work, locking off a camera, throwing out the do we pan, do we tilt, do we hit marks, but how effective it was and how long and how many you're engulfed in this story and you're realizing that there's certain tactics that for any film, short, documentary, experimental, are not being used. And I was also thinking of how some of the interviews were staged, that there wasn't the side, then always the exact close-up, then, how did you guys really, with the shot list, did you sit down and say, okay, we are not going to have this, no matter, even if it's called for? I mean, was it that meticulous? Because this, I mean, really, audience, I want you guys to know that this film, it will pass, I think it was about 45 minutes before I went, wait a minute, it hasn't tilted, it hasn't panned, it hasn't done, I don't want to spoil it because I want you guys to watch it. There's multiple other documentary techniques that are not used that sometimes I think filmmakers rely on. So what was the true, like, did it get that meticulous? Or did you guys just kind of say, we want to flow with the river of this, you know, like what you just explained?
It was all of those all the visual ideas were born out of what Yancey wanted to try to do with the film, which was to present this story of black middle-class family, strivers from the South who had moved to New York and in pursuit of the American dream, moved to the suburbs. And we have, Barbara Ford, the matriarch, is a school teacher who becomes a principal. Yancey's father, William Ford Sr., works for the Transit Authority, drives a J train. These guys were doing exactly what they were supposed to. And the way that their life was turned upside down is something that we wanted the visuals to give. The lives were turned upside down. And then the story of what happened that night when William was killed was written by the system, by the detectives, by the investigating police officers, by the family of the shooter. The system was able to write the narrative of what happened that night in a way that's all too common with black families in this country. So visually, the idea was to give the family back its agency and let them present the real story of who William was and what was going on in these circumstances that led to that night. So the camera not moving started as an idea of a low wide frame where people are seated dead center and giving agency, the kind of what Yancey calls the queen's chair for her mother, seated in her kitchen where she commands her house, and able to speak with an authority and with a, you know, with the honesty of who she was, and giving the audience a sense of, you know, giving the audience time to examine that frame and look and watch and listen and really be, and not give a cutaway or not given, you know, not giving folks a chance to look away or turn away from some painful story. So the visual stillness was always designed to present this idea of testimony, that the family and the people that knew William would be able to testify to who William was, because that was, because they weren't able to do that in real life.
Oh, okay. Cause that was, you know, that was what crossed my mind with, one of the times where I thought, you know, this almost feels like a court deposition. Like I'm not being,
right.
I can guarantee, one of the biggest reasons this film was nominated was because A, like you had mentioned, the problem with Black African-American families and the cops who somehow, when they shoot the white kids, they get them in the knee. But then they just seem to have needed to fire 12 times with the, and by the way, we're not censored here and your opinions are yours, mine are of the show. So, I can't stand,
okay.
I even have to do that disclaimer, but it's like, you know, it's let's like, we're talking the truth here. My mother is Mexican and I live in an area where there's a lot of Mexicans, and it's like, oh, 14 Mexican kids were killed by February and there was 2 white kids. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's not racial. So
yeah.
What I liked the most is what you just said, was that this film was not soapboxing, and my gosh, kudos to this family and to the team of keeping in order. Did you have a specific no soapboxing and no in any way alluding to all white people or all cops are bad or all people are bad, the justice system never works? I mean, was that a specific, like, you know, whoa, we just kind of came off like we're a little bit, you know, lumping, and we don't want to lump, we just want to tell the story? Was, because that was what I think you guys pulled off the best, was I didn't feel like I was watching a call to action of the justice system has never worked for anyone. So in terms of handling the story, was that something you guys were kind of constantly having to keep a loop on?
I don't think watching ourselves in that way. I mean, I think what was amazing for me was to sit in the room with folks that had a lot of things to say that had never been properly empowered to say them. And so what you hear in the film is what people were feeling and thinking. And I think the sense that, you know, maybe you didn't hear some of this, you know, some of these generalizations coming out is because that's, you know, I don't think that's a fair way to look at it. And knowing the Ford family the way I got to know them, you know, I don't think anyone was interested in that. I mean, they're talking about how the system works for a big part of our country. And I just think it was really honest. But I don't think it was guarded in the sense that, you know, that there was an that there was any kind of, you know, agenda or check or approach to it. I think we were just, we had the benefit of being able to speak to people for as long as they wanted to about what they wanted to. And that's where I think you get this real sense of intimate truth from folks. It was really remarkable.
We often
in documentary, you know, a long interview is, you know, maybe 3 or 4 hours if you can get someone to sit for that long. But we would, you know, we sat with Yancey's mother twice, probably both times for 8 or 9 hours, and we had plans to speak with her more. And Yancey's kind of self-interview that show up kind of repeatedly through the film as a bit of a narrative spine, we shot probably 9 or 10 long days with Yancey to get all that material. So we really had the luxury of a lot of time to let things flow in a natural way, not having to kind of fit it into a documentary interview situation.
Yeah, the pacing and the editing, I want to just give a kudos. I mean, I didn't watch the credits, the editing, and I know I was just overly studying the cinematography, and I of course was paying attention to the story. But what I liked so much about what you did was with the cinematography aspect was, you know, what you were just saying, an honest portrayal was, I felt like you were just putting me in an honest place to listen. This was one of the few documentaries I felt like where literally, as some scenes are at a dining table, where I was just sitting there listening. And I can guarantee that it has to be one of the biggest reasons it was nominated, because I didn't feel like I was being taken on this shaped ride where we had okay, by this moment in the film, and we got to follow this documentary rule. And just a quick note so people know, we didn't mention it in the beginning. Alan has shot multiple documentaries. Strong Island also won a special jury prize at Sundance, including Best Documentary Film at the Berlin International Film Festival. And he also recently finished shooting another film for Josh Zeman and Adrian Grenier, Vinny Chase. Sorry, I had to. And and this is, you know, that speaking of truth and honesty, that is so not how it happens for you so quick. So it's, that's one of the reasons I like that. But anyways, so what I want to know is, and again, anything I ask, obviously you don't have to answer. This is the premise of our show is like you and I are sitting at Starbucks and just chatting film. So we want the guests to feel comfortable. Now, I know usually the answer is story. And to me, as filmmakers, I'm a filmmaker myself, that's the obvious one, or you want to explore something. But what for you was the spark for you personally that said, okay, I'm going to give 6, 8, 10, however many months it takes to do this film. We all know what filmmakers have to put aside or what they have to go through. What was the spark for you that said, okay, you know what? I'm in. I'm surfing. This is the wave I want.
For me, it was meeting Yancey and hearing about what he wanted to do with the form and how he wanted to use the cinematic techniques to undergird this story, which is something that I don't think had really ever been told from the perspective of the victim's family. You know, as it is in this country, you know, the stories are also are often written by everyone except the victims. So to me, that was very exciting. The way Yancey was talking about using the camera and cinematic techniques to you know, really orientate this story in a space, an experiential space for the audience, so that when folks were watching, you could really try to take, you know, use the mechanics of film to create an experience for people. I've had people say that the film is kind of like VR without the goggles. It's like emotionally immersive in a way that, you know, I think people, when you see it in the theater with a room full of people, there's moments where everyone is just holding their breath together. And it's a really, I think, it's proof of power of cinema to really, you know, translate story into feelings for people. And so for me, that was the most exciting thing, was that Yancey was needed to tell an important story, an essential story, but also wanted to do it in an important and groundbreaking way, which for a visualist like me was an incredible challenge and an incredible gift, because you know, like we all know, there's kind of a number of ways that documentaries get made, and the chance to kind of honor those rules but then ignore them was tremendously exciting for me. And that's why, I signed on as quickly as I could. And if I thought that I was going to give 8 or 9 months to the project, I would have been excited about it. I had no idea that I would be on the project for 7 years. Yancey and I shot together for 7 years.
Wow.
And we were in about 4 years in thinking, okay, we've got it now. We must be almost done. And then as the documentary gods will make you painfully aware, it was another 3 years after that. So all for the right reasons. I like to say that if you know when and how your documentary is going to wrap up, it's probably not a real documentary.
I think
films take the time they need to take. So it was a tremendous honor for me to work with a director that really had that vision to see it through and the incredible persistence when it gets, it got really hard for many, many, many years. And Yancey stuck with it. And we stuck with it together. Yancey honored me with letting me help produce the film for a spade in the middle. And then we started with some other producers and ended with some strong producers. And it was a really remarkable team effort. But yeah, for many, many years.
Well, congratulations and kudos to you, because I've just the number of B movie crap that I don't even tell people what it is, but it's landed on Amazon Prime through distribution companies, not through us throwing it up. And so I'm aware of something taking 5 years of your life, or you read that script and then before you know it, you're like, hey, wait a minute, I read that when I was 19 and now it's my 25th birthday and we're still marketing it. I didn't, And so I really admire that commitment, because I think filmmakers, and this is no arrogance, I think that real filmmakers should be willing to say, this is going to take what it takes. And I always say, I only want to work with people who will either show up at Sundance with me or stand by the audience if they're walking out. And so to hear about a bond that you guys, that's really what you need. You don't need people who are just there at the party and who want to congratulate you in Berlin or Sundance, or now all of a sudden you shot something Oscar nominated. And this film, it's nominated, but if I was presented this film, I would have loved it and told Meredith, hey, let's do this. Let's check it out. I of course watched it one time just to pick apart cinematography. Who am I to pick apart the DP of a Oscar-nominated documentary? But to bring what knowledge I just knew. And then I watched it for story. And what I really loved was there's so few documentaries and even films that you can actually watch so close, and it's not for work or because you have to. And you're actually re-engaged. And so to watch it as audience, I was kind of like, wow, I already know where this is going. I already know how it's shot. I already know the pacing. And I'm intrigued like this is new. And so I really wanted to congratulate you guys. And if you could you give a shout out. We love to acknowledge people on the team. Could you give the pacing of this was amazing. So if you could you give a shout out to the editor?
Yeah, the editor is Janus Billeskov Jansen, who's a Danish editor. He worked with Joshua Oppenheimer on The Act of Killing and the follow-up, which I'm forgetting, I'm forgetting this follow-up, two brilliant films. Janus is a wonderfully perceptive, very experienced editor who, I think he understood what Yancey and I had been trying to do with the visuals right off the bat. And Yancey, the interesting story about how Yanis came to work on the film was that Yancey had been working editing the film with Shannon Kennedy, who's a wonderful U.S.-based editor. And they had been doing a lot of work while we were concurrently shooting. And there was a wonderful feedback loop there where Shannon was getting footage and putting it together and then talking to me. And then I was shooting new footage and then talking to Shannon. And we had with the three of us had a really nice cyclical exchange, which led to some really, you know, Shannon was a big supporter in us to continuing to shoot in the rigorous way that we were. So that was a real affirmation. There came a point where Shannon had another project, and like I said, we thought we were going to be done about 4 years in, but the story took a change. There was a development in the family, and Yancey, you know, we realized we needed to keep going. At some point, Shannon had to step onto something else, and Yancey took that as an opportunity to really take a step back and realize that there was, you know, an even deeper level of storytelling to be had. So took some time off and ended up making this jump to starting the edit over in Copenhagen. And Yancey will tell you that leaving the United States and working in a foreign country that's almost, you know, that's a very non-diverse country was a really interesting way to kind of take a step back. And a lot of the work that happened in Denmark, having to explain to the Danish team the criminal justice system in America and how the grand jury proceedings can be sealed forever. No one will ever know what was said inside that grand jury that led to the shooter not being indicted. All this was totally foreign to the Danes. And so by Yancey having to explain this and try to justify, you know, the Danes were like, how can that be? That's crazy. And so having a little bit of distance from the American system, I think really allowed Yancey and Yanis to continue working the footage and bring it to a whole other level of kind of this interrogation of the American justice system. So it was a huge redirect that we started over. It's one of the reasons that it led to 7 years on, but I think it was totally worth it because Yanis had a great sense of what to do with this footage and the rigor that we were approaching it. So I'm really happy. Some of the choices that were made in the editing are just so fulfilling to me because when I would shoot, I was shooting and I would think, boy, we had a rule when you're shooting that no matter what shot I had framed up, even if we thought it wasn't going to work, I was to roll 60 seconds on it. So everything, we wanted to have the option to go long on everything. So no matter what, we would shoot 60 seconds. And, you know, when you have a great editor that can see the vision of that kind of work and then fold that into this rich storytelling, it's just, there's amazing stuff that happens. And when the sound, the composers got involved, they did really interesting work where they scraped sound out of the soundtrack and turned that into some of the tones in the sound in the film. They recorded sounds from within the house and within the garage, the actual garage where William was killed, within the house that Yancey grew up in, banging on pipes and the sound of the floors and things like that, and turned that into the musical score. So there's a really tremendous amount of the team was just incredible in how they built on the very fundamental ideas that Yancey came to me with, 9 years ago now. Sorry, there's a train going by.
Oh, hey, it's all good. No, yeah, you know what? It's interesting because what I always wanted to do was have the sound editor edit in coffee shop ambience so it would really sound like we were kicking it at a Starbucks together. I think that would be so
great
cool.
Great idea.
You are episode 274, so we appreciate you being here. I just have to do 1 second of show maintenance. For you new listeners, audience, supporters, you can find us at www.talkingpicturesla.com. We do have guests from all over the world, all over the country. The LA is just because the other domain name was taken. So again, that's www.talkingpicturesla.com. In the spirit of Oscar season, we are so thankful because we have this film, another nominee in the documentary category that you can check out on another episode, and then Miss Rachel Morrison for shooting Mudbound, the first woman to receive a cinematography nomination for an Oscar. So that's just a little bit of maintenance there. A question I had for you, Jacob, was, of course, it says here you've shot some other features and some other films. Do you have a dream? Unfortunately, due to the movie gods, we have to just kind of get into our wrap-up time, and I do apologize for that because I can see there's so much more interesting stuff here that we could discuss, and we thank you as always. We thank our, we're so thankful to guests. You've
my
done
pleasure.
Documentary. Oh, I truly appreciate that. We are. I always say if we didn't have guests, it'd be me and a mic and dead air. So it would have lasted four episodes. in fact, this show started because my friend said you love movies and you never shut up, so start a talk show. So basically,
do what you know, man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's like, you've made films, so guests are going to love that. You're going to understand what they talk about. You have here's the question. You have the story. You have the director you want to work with. Everything's in place, budget. What is your dream genre? Before you hang up your camera, you have to have this genre on your IMDb.
Oh, man. Man, I don't even know what to call it, but, I mean, documentary is very close to my heart. The authentic camera, the reactive camera is what really does it for me. I think if I had a Dardenne Brothers film on my resume, I could retire happy. That kind of, you know, rigorous and uncompromising European social realist drama, that's right up my alley. So... but you're right. It's a combination of, you know, finding the director with vision. I love to go in deep. So any director that has a strong point of view that they want to explore, I'm there. So hopefully you got
I love it. I love it because that shows that really shows in your work. It didn't surprise me when you said 7 years because I can just through, watching screeners for the show and then watching screeners for a selection committee I'm on and then going through the stuff that, you know, if we don't, we never criticize or bash a film. So if we don't like a film, we just tell the PR rep, you know, we didn't like it. And so we're not going to go on air and bash it. And then just being a film nut to where when the work's done, I watch movies and people are like, don't you do anything else? And I'm like, well, yeah, but film nuts, film junkies understand it. If you're a filmmaker and you host the podcast, you're probably going to be into watching movies and when you're not doing other stuff. So the last question is basically the opposite. The electricity's off. You haven't eaten for a week. But there's no way in hell that you're going to do this genre. Like, it's not bad story. It's same thing. The director's good and the story's there, but just you're not doing it. That genre you want nothing to do with.
Man. I don't know. Is there such a thing? I mean, I'd like to think I can find interest in almost anything. But again, with a good director and a good story, I think I would be right there. But I mean, I know that I've struggled. I know that I get intimidated and nervous thinking about comedy, broad comedy. I think I'm a dramatic guy. I like dramatic work, committed work. So I think it would be a real challenge. It'd be a good intimidating challenge for me to have to do a nice broad comedy. Although I have done some comedy and it's a lot of fun. It's just a lot. It's just a lot more work for me, apparently, for some reason. So, but
that's one of the toughest genres for sure. That's great because you're. It's what I love. Cinematographers always 99% of the time say I'm up for anything, or they say sci-fi first. And then they're still on the other side up for anything other than obviously porn. But it's other filmmakers that usually have an answer and say, I don't want to do that. I couldn't do horror. I'm scared of horror movies. I wouldn't produce one or shoot one. So that's why I'm so intrigued and interested and have had such this wonderful flourishing relationship with Meredith and her clients, because I have always just loved cinematography because I can't do it. I probably would have flunked film school if the teacher wasn't one of my mentors, but he just, pulled me aside. He's like, hey, you don't have to be a cinematographer. What you have to be is a guy who knows that the cinematographer isn't wasting your time or budget. And that's all you got to know. And I always, of course, when you're just a dipshit in film school, you don't realize how truthful it is. And then later on, I thought, hey, you know what? This is taking way too long. We're not setting up we don't even have a crane, so we're not doing a crane shot. So, yes, I love that cinematographers are just that, like, F it, and I'm going to get in there, and we're going to find what we can find. So it's been a great joy meeting, Meredith with, cinematographers from Australia and television and all that stuff. So the last thing I wanted to close up and saying is just again, we appreciate the time. I don't know if Meredith had told you that by coming on this show, anyone that wins has to thank our podcast. So please let your team know.
No pressure. Okay.
Yeah, you're up for an Oscar and you've been on our show, so you could retire today if you want.
That's the full package. That's great. I'll do my best. We're the ugly stepchild documentary stepchildren in the back of the Dolby Theater. So we'll see if they let any of us speak. But
just know your episode will be deleted. Please.
No pressure.
Any future projects. If you ever want to come on again, please let Meredith know.
I would like that.
Yeah. Any guests we've had some that have been on three or four times. To us, you're just you become another cousin on the family tree of our show. We are just about the love of film. So, keep that in your hat. This is a fantastic doc, and I'm very thankful that I got to talk to you and had the opportunity to ask questions and have this open conversation.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm so glad the film resonated with you, and I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing, talking about the form. It's a worthy conversation, so happy to be a part of it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, and please thank your director and your team for what you guys are doing, because this subject, we can never stop exploring it, the social ramifications, the racial stuff, just all our show is so behind that. So kudos to what you guys did and are doing. Excellent.
Awesome.
Well, you have a wonderful evening.
I hope your audience gets to check out the film Strong Island. It's on Netflix if you have Netflix. And I'm glad that this conversation's happening far and wide.
Yeah, we bill ourselves as the free audio commentary since DVD's gone. So we've had something, this is like film number 43 that's on Prime or iTunes, Netflix, or people could have seen it in theaters. So I just tell people, hey, you missed the audio commentary, watch it on Netflix and then come on over and hear the cinematographer. So
nice.
That's kind of, because I think we all miss DVD commentaries, but Anyways, take care, and you have a wonderful evening.
All right. Thanks a lot, Paul. Good night.
You're welcome. Bye. Good night. Bye. All right, Meredith, thank you so much. Thank you, Harry. Thank you, Alan. I got a jet, but it's always a pleasure talking pictures. It's my zone. I love it. And coming up, the Oscars are soon, so make sure you get on Netflix and watch Strong Island. Aloha, and make sure and watch a good movie today. Watch Strong Island.